After several hours had passed, Bridget was startled by the sound of the lock. She repressed a smile. The mags watching her at the other end of the visual audio hookup must have grown concerned over her immobility and sent someone to check.
We cannot be heard or observed now, so you can drop your act.
Bridget stood up, stretching her arms and rubbing her legs to restore circulation.
How could you sit like that for so long?
Elementary yoga. How long was it?
6 hours, I'm told. It's daybreak. Probably the last time the sun will ever rise on you.
Since I can't see it, it hardly matters, does it?
You lead rather a double life, don't you? A key-tapping archivist by day, an insurgent by night. Who are the preservationists?
The who?
We've known about them for quite some time, decades. You do know you're officially charged with sedition.
I have my defense ready.
It will avail you nothing. When treason is the charge, the Baron himself acts as the judge and jury, and the trials are conducted in secret.
And the verdict is already in.
Of course. However, you may receive a modicum of leniency if you tell me what you know about the preservationists.
I know nothing. I'm a historian.
And therefore, the perfect tool.
You seem to know more about them than I do.
The preservationists represent an underground resistance movement. They follow an idealistic principle of someday freeing humanity from the heel of the Barons by forcing the truth down their throats. If it were not for the laws of the Barons, as manifested in the Vils, we would still be barbarians, trying to reconstruct all the horrors of the pre-dark that led to the nuke cost.
Or we would have learned our lesson and built toward a utopia.
Oh, please. You should know better.
There is no balance, no equilibrium in this society. Historically, civilizations rose, attained high states of technological advancement, and then fell into ruin. Then, after a period of recovery, civilizations advanced again. A continuous, natural cycle. Something opposed this cycle, and civilization was pushed back on all fronts. It's an unnatural opposition, a subtle process of preventing the restoration of balance.
Do go on.
It's been close to 200 years since the Holocaust. With the sheer volume of pre-nuke tech that survived in this country alone, the rebuilding process should have been relatively swift. Even factoring in all the negatives, rad hotspots, hell zones, high infant mortality rates, I calculated the world should have reached a level comparable to the 1920s or 1930s at least two generations ago. There can be only one explanation. Someone, or something, is deliberately preventing our development. Because what we have in the Vils is minimal. And it's as though it's not even ours, but something on loan.
Ah. How much did you learn from the Dulsa file?
Not nearly enough. What is the Archon Directive?
It's the Directorate now, and has been for a very long time. 198 years, to be precise.
Since January 21st, 2001?
No wonder Kane had the hots for you. Beautiful and very bright. Unfortunately, not beautiful enough and too goddamn bright.
Was Kane involved in my arrest?
Knowingly, you mean?
Yes.
Would it make the prospect of your execution easier to endure if you knew Kane had been used?
It would.
Then you may go to your death never knowing if he betrayed you or not.
Another penalty? The sentence is death. Isn't that penalty enough?
No. I'll offer you a bargain, though. Tell me who your preservationist cohorts are, and I'll tell you the truth about Kane.
I'll ask him myself.
You'll never see him again. He has a new set of priorities now, and you don't even qualify as a footnote.
You really hate him, don't you?
What makes you think that?
Body language.
For a long moment, Salvo glared darkly at her, his lips working as if he were preparing to spit at her. Then he broke into a delighted grin.
By God, you are the prettiest and most perceptive insurgent I've ever arrested. You're right, Baptiste. I hate him.
Tell me why. I promise it won't make my execution easier to face.
A lot of reasons, some of which are purely instinctive, I guess. Maybe he's my yin to his yang, or vice versa. A more tangible reason is that my father and his father were enemies.
Is nursing old grudges a family tradition?
If you are a magistrate, family tradition and family honor is all important. Our entire discipline is based on it.
Kane doesn't seem to like you very much, but he doesn't appear to be carrying an enmity from the last generation.
That's because he isn't aware of it. I saw to that.
I don't understand. His father did something to your father, and you don't want him to know, yet you still hate him for it?
I didn't say it was completely rational. It's vindication, my dear. Revenge for the wrongs compounded upon my family name, my family honor. But none of this has any bearing on you and your situation, does it?
It might make for interesting testimony at my trial.
Your testimony won't be worth shit, Baptiste. That's the beauty of the Baron's court.
He turned and rapped sharply on the door with a fist.
I don't mind admitting I'm reinterpreting my standing orders a trifle. I was instructed to obtain as much information as possible from you before your execution, but I'd rather not waste my time on torture. You're only a pawn. Whatever you know will die with you. Your trial is scheduled for 0800. Sentence will be carried out at 0830.
After giving his statement to Pollard, Grant had been directed to go home and not contact his friend until the matter had been thoroughly looked into. Since Salvo was strangely unavailable, he had figured that a deeper investigation of the incident would have to wait until the following day. Now Grant stood gazing out the window into the deep indigo sky, looking for a sign that a new day was dawning. A quick glance at his wrist chron told Grant that dawn was only an hour or so away. Only Kane would be so defiant as to contact him after he'd been ordered not to do so. But then he wasn't stupid. Transcom frequencies were public, and he was absolutely sure Intel had a monitor on both his and Kane's units.
Yes?
Grant?
Yes, sir.
I hope I didn't wake you. I've gone over your statement. I regret to say I'm putting you on suspension until further notice.
Excuse me, sir?
Confine yourself to quarters. I'll be sending around a couple of men to pick up your equipment. Abrams insisted on it. Protocol and all that, you know.
I see. What about Kane?
He seems to think you were the target, not Boone.
Yes, I know. I suspect it too.
Then the primary question is why you? Can you offer any clues?
No, I can't. Maybe Guana Teague can.
What does the pit boss have against you personally?
I have no idea, sir.
I have a few. The blaster recovered at the scene was one of two that disappeared from the armory.
What?
Mag selling goods to pit merchants isn't without precedent, you know.
Something like that hasn't happened in either of our lifetimes. Are you accusing me?
Not yet, I'm not. Tell me, were you getting impatient for your administrative transfer to come through? Did you decide to cut a little jack on the side?
Grant said nothing. His hands trembled in fury. He felt as if he were trapped in a burning building with every exit door locked.
You're not charged with anything, and you may never be. But you'll have to pull some pretty impressive moves to redeem yourself in my eyes.
Sir?
You have your orders. Out.
Grant looked at the transcom unit in his hand, then hurled it the length of the room. It struck against the far wall, denting the duroplast. He sat motionless at the desk, wrestling with his rage, staring out of the window without seeing anything. A pre-dark term floated through his mind, and though old, it was very appropriate. Scapegoated. He was being scapegoated over this, while Kane, for whatever reason, was being haloed. He tried to wrap his mind around the possibility that Kane had rolled over on him to save his own ass. He couldn't. The concept of such a betrayal was too stunning, too nauseating to dwell upon. The worst part was, he couldn't even call Kane to ask him about it.
Grant?
Fuck. Great. Now I'm hearing things.
Grant. Grant.
Grant stiffened. The faint whisper wasn't emanating from empty air or his brain. He turned and dragged his coat from the back of the chair. He drew out the pin mic from the lapel and brought the receiver button up to his ear.
Damn it, Grant.
Kane, what the fuck are you doing?
Don't worry. This is a closed frequency, remember? Not like the transcoms. Listen, I've got something to tell you.
I've got something to tell you. I just heard from Salvo. He suspended me.
On what grounds?
On the grounds of your statement.
Shit.
Yeah, shit is right. He almost accused me of handing the blasters over to Teague, said they were stolen from the armory.
There's no way he could have known that unless he was the one who stole them.
Why would he do that?
Listen to me. You've got to get out of there.
You listen to me. For some reason, Salvo wants my ass on a platter.
Shut up and listen. Is someone coming around to collect your equipment?
Yeah, that's standard after a suspension.
Get out of there, Grant. I can't explain further, but I've learned some things.
What kind of things?
The kind of things that are getting people I've been in contact with chilled. So stop asking me questions and go.
Go where?
Tartarus. Remember that route we found down into the pits a few years ago?
Yeah, but it's probably blocked off by now.
It's your only chance to get out of the enclaves undetected.
Why would I want to do that?
Don't you get it? Salvo's sending a chill squad after you. You're on suspension. You're suspected of corruption. You decided to go out in a blaze of glory. That's how the report will read.
Have you found another bottle of wine or what? Why would he do that? And how would you know that?
You stubborn bastard. It's too complicated to explain. I'm asking you, Grant. I'm begging you. Trust my instincts again and get the hell out of there. Hit the pits, grab Guana, and squeeze him.
And then what am I supposed to do?
I'm working on it. Now will you please get your shit together and get...
All right, goddammit, I'm getting.
Good. I don't want to risk calling you again. I'll meet you at Guana's place as soon as I can.
You'd fucking well better.
Grant stared at the pin mic for a moment, then released it, allowing it to zip back to its place in the coat's lapel. Mentally, he replayed the conversations of Salvo and Kane. Then he got up, strapped on his sinier, shrugged into his coat, and left his flat. His quarters were on the same level as Kane's, but located considerably farther down on the central promenade. He walked quickly in the opposite direction from the entrance gate. There was no doubt at all about the way to Tartarus Kane had mentioned. The only problem was how to reach it swiftly without attracting attention. There was nothing he could do to avoid spy eye fixtures on the ceiling except to brazen it out. If what Kane said possessed even a gram of truth, leaving his quarters against orders wouldn't be much of an infraction. The double-facing row of flats ended after 100 yards, right against a blank wall. Ferns and shrubbery were planted in a wide strip along the width of the wall to give it the illusion of a garden vista. Several years before, he and Kane had discovered that one section of the wall was a facade, imitation rockcrete covering a service shaft. A maintenance tech on the premises explained that the opening extended down to a ventilation shaft, which then connected to the inner shell of the administrative monolith. For the hell of it, Grant and Kane had explored the shaft and discovered it reached far more than a ventilation shaft. Grant pushed through the shrubbery, inspecting the rear wall. He found the panel easily enough, and the inch-thick, 4-foot square of textured duraplast swung outward on hidden hinges. Staggered tie bars were just within reach. He put his feet on the first one and fished his flashlight out of a pocket. He carefully climbed hand over hand down to a square opening covered by a thick wire grill. That hadn't been there the first time. Placing the flashlight between his teeth, wrapping his left arm around a tie bar, Grant crooked his fingers into the grill and tugged experimentally, then with all his strength. The mesh ripped loose from the metal frame, yanked and folded it to one side, letting it dangle by an upper corner. It required a few painful contortions to step from the tie bars into the square ventilation shaft. It wasn't much wider than his shoulders, and he had to lie on his stomach and pull himself along the polished metal. Fortunately, it was easy going, and this particular shaft was only a score of yards long. It ended at a maintenance walkway inside the administrative monolith, somewhere between D and E levels. He pushed open another grill and climbed out. He walked along the narrow catwalk until he reached the upper landing of a corkscrew staircase. As quickly and as quietly as he could manage, he walked down the steps, the beam of his flashlight lighting the way. Pipes, conduits, and ventilation ducts ran up and down the shaft all around the staircase. He went down, down, clinging to the handrail. The monolith's levels could only be entered through the 4 enclave complexes, and as far as anyone knew, the only way in or out of them was via the bank of public elevators. But his route led to one other exit, providing it hadn't been discovered and sealed. As he got closer to the muffled throb of machinery, he knew he was nearing the end of the staircase. The thin beam of his flashlight made a splash of white on a steel-braced lead door. He experienced a momentary disorientation. The door led to the manufacturing facility on E level, and that appeared to be the only exit. Recalling the path he and Kane had followed that day, he turned right at the foot of the staircase. He shone his flashlight up and down along the far wall. A gap was visible between a retaining wall and the foundation. It was barely large enough to admit him, and then only if he turned sideways. He crab-walked into the gap, the beam from his light cutting through a gray mist of dust stirred up by his boots. Jagged edges caught at his coat and his stomach. He didn't remember that happening the first time, and he realized, with a surge of annoyance, that he had probably become bulkier since then. The narrow passage curved slightly, following the construction of the outer monolith wall. The ground beneath Grant's feet suddenly fell away. If he hadn't been so tightly wedged, he would have fallen. His flashlight showed him earth slanting downward beneath the foundations. Erosion had taken its toll in the years since he had last been here. He continued inching along, bracing the toes of his boots against the opposing wall. He progressed only a few yards before chunks of rockcrete collapsed under the pressure of his feet. Grant managed to keep hold of his flashlight when he dropped, thrashing into the darkness. He didn't fall far, nor was it as much a fall as a feet-first slide. Dust and grit rose in choking clouds as his body plowed a trench through the slope of loose, ancient dirt. Skidding to a slow stop on the seat of his pants, he shone the flashlight beam around. He had reached his destination sooner than expected, and by another method, but he had reached it. Cobaltville had been built upon the foundations of Vistaville, which had been built upon the ruins of an old pre-dark military storage depot. Beneath the enclave towers lay a chain of fuel cisterns, probably abandoned before the nuke cost. At one time, the ground around the enclaves had been honeycombed with reinforced concrete storage tanks. Even now, nearly 200 years after Skydark, the faint, acrid odor of gasoline still clung to the cistern walls. Grant waited until he got his bearings before moving again. He and Kane had entered the cistern area by another way, and he swept his surroundings with a flashlight until he found what he was looking for, only a few dozen yards away. A series of staple-shaped ladder rungs was embedded in the curving wall of the cistern, leading up to an overhead metal hatch. It was sealed by a thick disc of iron. Grant scaled the rungs and pushed up on the metal plate, hoping it hadn't been covered with stone or welded shut. He tried not to shove too hard, because he couldn't guess who or what might lie immediately beyond. The cover didn't budge, so Grant pushed harder. He could only use one arm, having to keep the other hooked through a rung. He shoved again, straining, and finally the metal disc shifted. Rust and dirt showered down from the rim. He forced the hatch cover up several inches, held it there until he climbed another rung, then shouldered the heavy disc aside. Before he dragged himself up and out, he turned off the flashlight. He found himself standing in the same alley he and Kane had climbed into years before. A draft carried the strong stench of rubbish and excrement. Looking up, he saw the sky was beginning to lighten with the approach of dawn. Grant kept to the side lanes, avoiding the main thoroughfare just in case Salvo had indeed ordered a pit sweep. It was either too early or too late for most of the pit dwellers to be up and about. He walked along a street that was little more than an alley of abandoned tar-paper shacks and shanties. Though he knew where he was going, he had to approach it by an unfamiliar route, and it cost him time. Dawn was breaking up the dark sky with scraps of yellow and orange when he sighted the corrugated metal warehouse. It took him something over 15 minutes to make a slow, careful circuit of the warehouse and the squat, low-roofed, windowless building attached to it. At the end of that time, he had satisfied himself there were no tripwires or vidcams or even a sentry. The only way into Teague's home was through the warehouse. Grant walked briskly to the side door. Lifting it against its hinges by the shank of the handle, he turned the handle slowly. The door was held fast on the other side by a chain. Alert for any sounds from within, he leaned his entire weight against the door. The bracket holding the chain pulled out from the rotten frame. The sound didn't seem loud enough to Grant to wake anyone from slumber. As he stepped warily into the warehouse, Grant's eyes swiftly took in the interior. There were boxes and crates stacked in helter-skelter fashion all over. The only attention to any kind of precision was a sprawling tall pyramid of boxes, wooden pallets, and square containers against the far wall. The flagstone floor shone with moisture, and the bare ceiling rafters were festooned with cobwebs. The light illuminating the warehouse was daylight, pale, dirty daylight, peeping in through a high, grilled window. Grant smelled nothing but mold, mildew, and urine. He waited for some sound, but there was none. He crept to the side of a large wooden packing crate. His eyes settle on a door on the far side of the place. Swiftly, soundlessly, he moved through the jumbled maze of boxes. Then the door opened and somebody came in.
Don't fucking worry about it. It's covered.
Grant was saved from immediate detection because the man who emerged paused at the threshold to exchange a few words with someone behind him. Grant dropped to his knees behind a stack of cardboard cartons. He stared hard at the tall, spare figure in the doorway. Even in the uncertain light, he saw the resemblance to Dos. He also saw the mini Uzi dangling from a strap around his neck. Uno closed the door behind him, glanced around for a moment, then walked purposefully across the warehouse, straight for Grant's position. Grant didn't want to draw the Sin Eater until the last possible second because the spring-powered cable made a distinctive click. Uno came on until he was a bare 10 feet away. Abruptly, he turned aside. His back to Grant, he strode quickly to the pyramid of crates and boxes. Grant watched him carefully. Uno spread his arms wide, fitting his hands around several containers at the base of the pyramid. The boxes of the lower tier all lifted away in one piece, attached to one another by glue or some other adhesive. With the ease of familiarity with the procedure, Uno removed one entire side of the pyramid. Grant crept forward a few feet for a closer look. Inside the shell of containers was a low-slung, treaded vehicle. It bore a likeness to the Sandcats, rough terrain wags stored in the armory. But though its contours were similar, it looked far older. The front, sides, and rear were sheathed by rust-stained armor plates. The windshield glass was streaked with dust and cracked in places. Grant wasn't terribly surprised. Some Outlanders, particularly the Roamers, traveled around in retooled pre-dark vehicles. As pit boss, Guanati could have smuggled the Sandcat into the bill in pieces and assembled it here for the eventuality he never needed to beat a hasty exit. Teague evidently felt the need now. Uno opened the driver's door. He leaned inside, fiddling with the instrument panel. Behind him, Grant left the shadows in long strides, moving silently on the balls of his feet. He snatched the leather strap of the autoblaster around the strong arm's neck and yanked. Grabbing at empty air, Uno fell backward right into Grant's outthrust knee. He clawed first for the Uzi, but that was beyond his reach. Then he clawed at the strap cinched tight around his throat. Grant kept the pressure on Uno's carotid artery until the man's struggles weakened and finally ceased. He eased him down to the damp floor and dragged him to the rear of the pyramid. He quickly detached the strap from the blaster, and by looping and knotting it expertly, he hogtied the man in a matter of seconds. Patting him down quickly, he found no other weapons. Cutting off a man's oxygen and the flow of blood to the brain was usually good for 5 minutes of unconsciousness. Tucking the mini Uzi into a coat pocket, Grant returned to the door. Pressing his ear to the wood, he heard voices.
I'm telling you right now, it's not time to renegotiate your contract.
I said my contract. Contract over now. I don't have a contract anymore.
The doorknob rattled, turned from the inside, and he had to act now. He tensed his wrist tendons and the Sin Eater slid into his hand. Setting himself, he raised his right leg and kicked the door.
Ah, shit!
It flew open, the edge clipping Guanateague and slapping him sideways. He slammed into the wall, bounced off, and fell heavily. Grant leapt through the doorway.
Freeze!
The boar of the Sin Eater covered both people in the bare-walled room. Teague remained on the floor, goggle-eyed and gape-mouthed with shock. He was uglier and fatter than Grant remembered. He wore a sleeveless shirt that exposed his greenish, flabby arms. The girl was the same albino whom they had pursued into the ambush. Grant looked hard at her, from her short, untidy white hair bound by a colorful scarf, her piquant face and shapely arrangement of curves beneath a tight t-shirt and very short, very red shorts. A pair of bulging duffel bags lay on the floor, one near where the pit boss had fallen.
Taking a trip? Let's see your travel permit.
Please, magistrate's mercy.
Shut up.
He strode over to Teague, who cringed away, scooting on the seat of his baggy pants until his back was pressed against the whitewashed wall. Grant went to one knee beside him and planted the bore of the weapon against his forehead.
I'm going to ask you a few questions. If you don't answer them, if I think you're lying, or if I simply don't like your attitude, I'll blow your head off. You understand?
Yes, yes.
You tried to have me chilled.
Yes.
Someone hired you.
Teague hesitated, and Grant dug the boar into his forehead.
No, yes, I mean, oh, hell, I don't know.
Oh, I know, I know.
What's your name?
Domi.
Your Guana's piece?
He forced me, held me prisoner.
Uh-huh, right. All right, Domi, what do you know?
I show you.
She turned and moved toward the wall behind her.
Freeze, goddammit!
Have to show.
Domi, don't.
Show what?
A cam, hidden in wall.
Show me then, but do it slow. Hear me?
Domi nodded, stepped carefully to the wall, ran her hands over the surface, and swung open a square panel. Slowly, she picked up an object from the recess and turned, holding it in both hands.
A transcom. Standard mag issue. Where'd you get it, Guana?
From a mag.
The truth, you sack of blistered muti fat.
I swear, a man gave it to me.
Who?
I don't know. He was an armor. He just handed it to me.
When?
Years ago. It's an arrangement kind of thing. Every once in a while I'll get a call on it, and I'm told to arrange things.
And somebody called you on a mag transcom and told you to arrange my murder?
Oh, I'm sorry, Grant. I ain't got nothing against you. It wasn't personal.
I'm relieved to hear that. I've got nothing against you either, Guana. No more than I have against any other swill bucket that decided to get up and walk around. Why chill me?
I don't know. He told me to chill you in the other bag.
Kane?
No, not Kane. This whole thing was about Kane. The cherry mag, Boone. If he got in the way, you were supposed to be blown away in front of Kane real messy, traumatic-like, you know?
No, I don't know. Where'd you get the blasters?
I found them here one night, about a year ago.
Have you been contacted since the hit went sour?
Yeah, about 2 hours ago on the transcom. Told me I fucked up Royal, but he could fix it, do some damage control. Said for me to sit tight, keep low, not to try and split the bill. Said I was still of use to him.
Judging from those duffel bags, I'd say you didn't believe him.
Would you in my shoes? I admit it, I was running to the Outlands.
If a mag is behind this, they'll come after you, guaranteed, with a squadron of deathbirds, and blow your two-ton ass to the coast.
Domi claims to know a way overland into the Mesa Verde hell zone. Figured I could lose any trackers there, then move on. Maybe to one of the Western Islands or even the Darks, for there ain't no barons and no mags.
On your feet.
The pit boss slowly lumbered to his feet. He cast a slit-eyed stare at Domi.
You bleached out little gaudy slut.
Grant whirled as Uno, the leather strap dangling from one wrist, bore down on him, a length of nail-studded wood in his hands. His face was a bare-toothed snarl of hurt pride and unthinking murderous fury. Grant pointed the Sin Eater and let loose with a three-round burst. Three holes were stitched across Uno's shirt front. The multiple impacts slammed him back and down in a twisted tangle, blood flying in liquid arcs from his chest. A tremendous weight slammed into Grant's back with bone-jarring force, cannonading him forward out the door. His feet struck Uno's corpse, and he fell on his face, sliding across the flagstone floor. He levered himself onto his back an instant before Guana Teague hurled his body atop his. The wind was literally crushed from his lungs. Teague's hand closed tightly over his right wrist, immobilizing it and keeping the Sin Eater aimed at the ceiling. The pit boss not only outweighed him by a minimum of 100 pounds, but he was far stronger than he looked. He combined over 300 pounds, strength, and years of experience as a pit fighter with an outpouring of adrenaline-driven energy generated by sheer terror. He tried to gouge Grant's eyes, and the squeezing pressure of his knees was like an iron band tightening around his ribcage. With his free hand, Grant clawed for his attacker's face, but the fat man twisted aside and locked the fingers of his left hand around the magistrate's throat, the thumb pressing cruelly into his windpipe.
Domi! Domi!
Over the man's shoulder, Grant saw the girl appear, a very long serrated knife gripped in both of her hands. She held it over her head. Her ruby eyes were wild and bright with kill light. Grant heaved and bucked, struggling to throw Teague's mammoth bulk aside, if only for a second, but it was like trying to wrestle a mountain. Desperately, he flailed with his legs, hoping to kick Domi or her knife before she plunged it into him. Suddenly, Guanateague stiffened, head snapping up and back. His eyes widened and bulged, filled with surprise and pain. A tendril of bright crimson emerged from Teague's mouth. Domi withdrew the long blade from Teague's back. Half of its length glistened with blood. With his head up and back, his throat presented a vulnerable target. The knife blade slashed once, very expertly, from behind. The flesh beneath his tripled chins opened up in a red-rimmed caricature of a smile. Bright arterial blood cascaded from the wound, drenching Grant as though he were standing beneath a waterfall. Guanateague collapsed, his spasming bulk falling forward and all but smothering Grant.
Oh, fuck this!
Grant tore his wrist free of the now slack fingers. He heaved and elbowed and thrashed to roll the grotesque corpse off himself.
God damn!
Domi kicked the mound of flesh again and again, grinning in triumph, tears shining on her cheeks.
Got this. Lizard dick! He is... big time chilled!
Swiping at the blood on his face with a sleeve, Grant climbed unsteadily to his feet.
Enough. Domi, you chilled him. Big time.
She stopped kicking and let the carmined blade dangle from her small fist. Then she threw herself against Grant, pressing her face to his chest. Her slim frame quivered. Automatically, he held the girl, cradling her bandaged head. He felt very weary.
I suppose you expect me to thank you.
Yes.
I guess there's a first for everything, Outlander girl. I thank you.
With a faraway shock, he realized that he didn't know what to do next. That was quite a novelty for him.
Grant.
When Grant heard the faint voice from the transceiver on his lapel, he felt almost absurdly grateful. Kane would no doubt have a list of suggestions, even if most of them made no damn sense. Even refuting them would be a relief at this point. Domi lifted her head, blinking in puzzlement at the transceiver button. Her face had been pressed against it, muffling the sound. Grant gently pushed her away and drew the pin mic up to his lips.
I'm here.
Good. This is Salvo. Stay there until we come for you.
Bridget paced her cell, her mind busy, battling with her emotions. She knew it was nearing 0800, and she could no longer submit to the relaxation techniques. There was nothing she could do but wait for the eighth hour. Even with what was ahead of her, she couldn't keep the thought of Kane out of her head. Either he had been arrested and was awaiting trial, or once he had successfully ensnared her, he had moved on to another assignment. A magistrate in full armor stood there, frowning beneath his red-tinted visor. Behind him, Bridget saw another pair of armored mags. The man tossed her a threadbare, faded yellow bodysuit.
Put it on.
She did so, trying not to think of all the condemned prisoners who may have worn it in the past. Boot socks were attached to the legs of the shapeless garment, and she adjusted the Velcro tabs until they fit her feet snugly.
Okay.
Flanked by the two mag guards, she was led away. Bridget expected to be marched down the chill, sterile corridor to some sort of courtroom. Instead, she was escorted only a dozen yards down the hall and put into a chamber not much larger than her cell. At least this room had a piece of furniture, a high-backed, sturdy wooden chair with the legs bolted to the floor. The chair faced a small monitor screen. Bridget sat down before it. On the screen, a vague, misty outline took shape, like the head and shoulders of a man hidden behind veils of chiffon and backlit by golden sun lamps. The mag shut the door behind her. None would see or hear what went on within the chamber. None would ever know the testimony she gave, except Baron Cobalt. Bridget stiffened, cold sweat springing in icy drops at her hairline. She shuddered to the depths of her soul.
Citizen Baptiste, you stand accused of dissent, sedition, and treason against the Ville. You are further accused of illegal possession of Ville property. If you have anything to say before sentence is pronounced, speak now.
Bridget forced herself to stare into the vid lens on the wall beside the screen.
I am innocent of these charges, Lord Baron. save that I did have in my possession the said piece of Ville property. Here is my defense. I was engaged in following a line of inquiry ordered by the Magistrate Division. I had no idea the orders had not been sanctioned by Kane's superior officer.
You were aware the information you accessed was restricted. You used an authorization code that was not your own.
Curiosity and fear, Lord Baron. Magistrate Kane had piqued my interest, and I feared for my safety if I disobeyed him.
The Baron didn't speak. He waited, and Bridget was encouraged slightly. So far, Baron Kobold hadn't mentioned that Kane was acting as an undercover op to expose a suspected preservationist.
And to the charges of sedition and treason, I plead innocent. As for the computer, I plead guilty, and I throw myself on the mercy of the Baron. I claim I meant no wrong.
You are a clever dissembler. Very well. I will dismiss the charges of possessing the computer. I grant you mercy. However, the other charges remain intact, and as you know, are punishable by death.
It was what she expected. Bridget bowed her head.
You must understand, I'm not sentencing you to death for these arbitrary reasons. Even if you are a preservationist, that's not what brought you here before me.
What did then?
Knowledge. It can lead to wisdom and thus to humility, true enough. But in this tortured period of humankind's existence on Earth, knowledge beyond what is needed must also bring death.
Why is that so?
Humanity stands on the threshold of a new genesis. It cannot pass over that threshold if collective knowledge expands.
I don't understand.
That is the entire point. If you understood, if humankind as a whole understood, the mad rush to mass destruction would begin again. Humanity lives inside its head. That is the seat of the soul. This is true subjectively as well as objectively. If you control the soul, you control humanity. The course of execution is set by expedience and custom. You will die quickly and painlessly, if that is of any comfort to you. The sentence is to be carried out forthwith.
The magistrate prodded Bridget to her feet and removed her from the room. Only the one mag accompanied her down the corridor, his sin-eater drawn and aimed at her head. As she marched, she was desperately contemplating some outburst of violence, some assertion of the will to live, even knowing that it would never succeed. They entered an elevator, and the car dropped swiftly. She was too numb to count the levels. Bridget and her guard were met by three more armored mags. The trio surrounded her and conducted her down a long corridor toward a square archway covered by a metal slab. One of the four magistrates increased his pace and reached for a lever jutting out from the frame of the arch. He pulled it up, and the slab moved upward, operated by a combination of hydraulics and pneumatics. Beyond the arch, the overhead lights were an eye-searing blaze. Bridget squinted and made out a blank, featureless wall. No, not exactly featureless. It bore deep pockmarks and dark stains. A set of wrist and leg shackles hung from the wall by brackets. She wasn't surprised that the mode of execution was a basic firing squad, but she did wonder what they would do with her body. Bridget marched onward, forcing her head erect. She had no plan except to die without shaming herself. To weep and beg for mercy would not accomplish anything or delay the inevitable. The mag at the lever reached out and took her roughly by the arm, pulling her aside.
Magistrates, take your positions. Make sure your weapons are properly primed. We want no misfires.
The three magistrates stepped beneath the arch. Immediately, the armored man slapped at the lever, and the heavy metal panel rushed down, hitting the floor.
Don't stand there gawking, Baptiste.
Sorry. That's murder on the throat. Anyway, they're locked in, but they can come call for help.
Kane!
Move it!
Bridget started running beside Kane, who appeared to have no trouble jogging in the armor. She tried to think of something, anything, to say.
I didn't recognize you.
You weren't supposed to. Can you run any faster?
Instead of increasing her speed, she came to a complete halt. Kane sprinted on for a few yards, realized she wasn't beside him, slowed and whirled around, advancing on her.
Do you want to die?
No, but I don't want to participate in a mag scam. How do I know this rescue isn't a farce, a trick to lead you to a preservationist hideout?
Is there one? Are you really a preservationist?
Not exactly. Somebody claiming to represent them contacted me anonymously last year, but I never spoke to anyone or met anyone. As far as I know, the preservationists are nothing more than a straw adversary, a front for a mag op.
And as far as I know, I'm helping a traitor escape from a deserved death sentence.
The man and woman regarded each other silently. Then Bridget gave Kane her smile.
Paranoia is such a subtle yet devastating weapon, isn't it?
You're not paranoid if they're really after you, Baptiste.
There's the conundrum. I don't know if they really are after me.
Trust me on this. They are.
What's the plan?
I'm making it up as I go along. For the moment, we're hitting the pits.
Bridget tried to consider his words dispassionately, realized she couldn't, so she started running again.
Okay.
Kane caught up and fell into step beside her.
What convinced you?
If this were a trick, you would have described a cunning and devious scheme full of twisty-turny strategies.
Because I'm flying by my ass, you have faith in me?
Sure.
Oh.
They spoke no more, devoting their breath to running. They sprinted along the corridor, around corners, following bends, keeping close to the walls. Bridget followed Kane's lead. He seemed to know where he was going. When she heard the steady throb of machinery, she realized they were on E-level, the manufacturing facility. Coming to a stop at an L-junction, Kane gestured for her to keep back, then peered around the left-hand corner. A moment later, he waved her forward. A long vista of great machines opened up, arrayed in a number of extended lines. Mechs and techs, wearing protective goggles and headgear, operated the equipment. She saw drill presses, forges, smelters, crucibles. Some of the machines shot sparks, emitting the metallic odor of ozone, while others spit jets of steam. Chain conveyors rattled in jerks and starts. A forest of girders supported a trussed network of overhead catwalks. She had never been here before, and she understood why. The teeth-jarring racket, the sparks, and the clouds of steam gave it an aspect of a pocket-sized hell on Earth. This was the level devoted to feeding comfort to the enclaves, producing and manufacturing, and in many instances, reproducing and remanufacturing tools, weapons, engine parts, and fixtures of all sorts.
See that door on the far wall?
No!
Doesn't matter. Follow me. Don't look around. No matter what happens, just keep going.
Kane started off, walking in brisk, long-legged strides. Bridget followed him. The noise, the smell, the heat, all were a physical assault. She felt her bones vibrating. The air was stagnant, choked with the thick odors of grease and superheated metal. She kept her eyes on Kane's black-shelled back, trying to imitate his steady, measured tread. The few people in their path barely glanced at them. Once they saw Kane's armored figure looming out of the mist, they immediately directed their attention elsewhere. Long before they reached the door, Bridget was perspiring and breathing heavily. The lead-shielded door bore an exclamatory warning in white paint. Absolutely no admittance beyond this point. No exceptions. The hasp was secured by a thick padlock, almost the size of her fist.
Do you have a key?
Kane nodded, lifting his right hand. The Sin-Eater sprang into it, flame blooming from the barrel. The padlock jumped and broke apart. Kane ripped the shattered mass from the hasp and pushed open the door. It appeared to require quite a bit of effort. He stepped through, looked around, and indicated with a gesture that the way was clear. After Bridget stepped through, he pulled the door closed. The air was much cooler, and Bridget couldn't help but sigh in relief. They stood in almost complete darkness at the bottom of a high shaft. She could barely make out the contours of a corkscrew staircase twisting up into the dimness.
I can barely see.
I've got the visor. I'll see for both of us.
Where to now?
Like I said, Tartarus.
Why are you doing this for me? You're risking everything.
Partly because I'm responsible. You were just doing your job, what a magistrate told you to do.
Is that all?
No. I have to know what you learned, why it scared the shit out of Salvo.
He didn't tell you?
All he told me was that this Dulsa place figures very prominently in the plans of the Trust.
The Trust?
Tell me what you know, and if we have the time, I'll tell you what I know.
Bridget talked quickly and quietly. Kane listened without interjecting comments or questions.
It's obvious that the seeds of the baronies were planted back in the 20th century, before the nuke cost. The totality concept, the redoubts, even this so-called Archon directive, were components of a far-ranging plan.
And the nuking interrupted it.
Or was part of it.
I don't understand.
Think about it. The population was reduced to a manageable level, to a point where concerted resistance against the unification program was utterly futile.
Kane gazed at her, even though she couldn't see him. He didn't know what to say. He wasn't even sure of his feelings. But the one emotion growing within him wasn't fear. It was despair. He took her hand.
Come on.
What about your story?
Later. Someone is waiting for us.
Sliding the metal disc to one side, Kane poked his head up and took a quick reck of the foul-smelling alleyway. He saw no one, and he crawled out. Bridget followed a heartbeat later, blinking in the early morning sunlight, almost overwhelmed by the odors.
Welcome to the Tartarus pits. The tour starts immediately.
Bridget didn't reply. She didn't have to, because her face displayed her emotions. Kane checked the mouth of the alley, found the lane clear, and gestured for her to join him. They moved only in shadows, working their way toward the east wall.
Have you come up with a plan yet?
More or less. I'm taking you to a man who can, if anyone can, smuggle you out of the ville.
To where?
The Outlands. Where else?
What makes you think I want to leave? I'd prefer the pits to the Outlands.
We're seizing the offensive here, Baptiste. I'm surprised we've gotten this far. But you can't stay in the pits. It's the first place the mags will search.
If I leave the ville, I'll be an...
An Outlander. It's better than being dead.
It's not supposed to be. I've thrown my whole life away.
He stroked her tangled, dirty hair clumsily, trying to soothe her.
No, Baptiste. You still have a life. It'll be hard, but it will be life.
What kind of life can I have in the Outlands? I'm an archivist, not a survivalist. Where will I go?
I don't know. Unless you know of a preservationist hideout or can find a secret gateway to paradise, you don't have many options. Neither of us does.
Bridget's eyes suddenly flashed brightly, overwhelming the fear in them.
Quantum interface map transinducers.
Excuse me?
They were colloquially known as gateways. I read about them, the redoubts, their locations. If we could find one...
What good will that do? Don't you need some kind of accessing or operational code?
The file I found listed the codes. I committed all of them to memory.
All of them?
All of them. I have an eidetic memory, a photographic memory. I see something once and I remember everything about it in detail, even numerical sequences. What?
Later, Baptiste. But keep on surprising me. I may be able to surprise you in return.
What again?
They hurried off, darting down, then up muddy back lanes. Kane couldn't keep the smile from returning to his face. An idea had sprung into his mind, full-blown. The plan was impossible, crazy, but it seemed absolutely lucid compared to the hopeless nightmare of the past couple of hours. Now, at least, there was a faint light of hope shining in the darkness of despondency. Of course, they still had to find a way to escape the ville undetected and reach the Hell Zone. But he was certain Guanatigue could offer up a few suggestions, especially if he believed his life was at stake, which it certainly was. When Kane finally saw the warehouse looming up against the inner ville wall, the first thing he noticed was the door ajar. With Bridget behind him, he pushed it open and stepped inside. Immediately, he knew something was wrong. He smelled it and he sensed it. Turning to Bridget, he put his finger to his lips, then filled his hand with the sin eater.
Find some cover. No matter what you hear or see, don't move.
She said nothing. She didn't even nod. The gaze she gave Kane was the same wary look she might cast toward a tiger if she came across one in her living quarters. It was a look Kane recognized. He had slipped into his magistrate persona as easily as he had slipped into his armor, and she sensed the change in him. Bridget followed the line of the wall, found a stack of boxes in a cobwebbed corner, and crouched down behind them, hands around her knees. Kane crept deeper into the warehouse, sidling into the shadows cast by stacks of crates. He followed his nose. The stink of blood and cordite was fresh. Peering around the edge of an open box of machine parts, he spied a flat ribbon of scarlet oozing over the flagstone floor. He didn't have to move closer to know what it was. The fat man lying on his side was 300 pounds of dead weight. Blood continued to sluggishly ooze from the gaping gash in his throat. The tall, lean man lying on his back, sightless eyes gazing up at the rafters, lay in a pool of blood too, just not so much of it. The front of his leather jacket was pulled away from his chest, revealing three bloody holes grouped neatly over the heart. Guanatigue's near decapitation wasn't a standard mag chill method, but Kane recognized the size of the bullet holes in Uno's torso, as well as the precision with which they'd been placed. He had to take a chance. He activated his comlink.
Grant.
Behind you.
Kane turned. In the center of the warehouse, before a high pyramid of stacked cartons and crates in a semicircle, stood eight magistrates. Six of them were in full armor, their bodies as rigid as stone. The two mags not in armor were Salvo and Grant, but their Sin Eaters were out and aimed directly at him.
Leather it, Kane, and come here.
Kane's visored eyes sought out Grant's. His dark face was drawn, lips tight.
Do as he says, Kane. I know the whole story now.
Why should I?
We're not here to chill you. We're here to help you.
Kane slowly approached them, the blaster still in hand.
Help me by chilling me.
No. We still want you, Kane. You just had an extreme reaction to what you've been through the last couple of days. It happens to the best of us.
Do the best of us help a convicted traitor escape her executioners?
You'll have to turn Baptiste over to us. She must die and you must accept it.
And Grant?
He wants to help you.
How are you supposed to help me, Grant?
You're delusional, Kane. Some sort of stress syndrome. It can happen.
I'm not fused. I'm not a jolt brain. I'm not delusional. Salvo is. He thinks he's saving the world from itself. And to do that, he schemes, lies, double-crosses, and chills anybody who gets in the way of his grand dreams, including all of us.
Kane slowed to a stop and stood motionless, legs braced and wide apart. He was about 20 feet away from the mag line.
Did you talk to Guana or Uno?
No. They attacked me before I could question them.
Kane saw the blood drying on Grant's coat, even though attempts had been made to sponge it away.
You cut Guana's throat?
Uno did. I came in on the middle of a fight between them. He snuffed Guana, and I was forced to put him down.
Leather your sidearm, Kane.
Leather your dick. And your fucking archons.
Salvo's lips went white, and the barrel of the Sin Eater jerked a trifle in reaction to Kane's words.
Kane!
Chill me, Salvo. Like you did Wreath. Before I start talking about the Archons, the Trust, Mattran's Gateways, about helping you to build a new world order of masters and slaves.
Grant suddenly stepped away from the line, his Sin Eater trained on his friend.
Kane, I'm begging you, as your partner and your friend, put away the blaster. Salvo told me you wouldn't be harmed, and I believe it. If he meant to hurt us, if he had planned the hit yesterday, I'd be dead by now, right?
Grant started walking toward Kane.
He explained all of it to me. How that preservationist bitch gave you a load of shit about what was on that disc you lifted, fed you a line about aliens.
Stop. No closer.
You won't shoot me, Kane.
Kane raised his blaster, centering the bore on the middle of Grant's forehead.
The hell I won't.